people will be more informed in different ways about how they come to do that. I think the understanding of the orchestra's function as a tool for social change will continue to grow and develop.
Mark, from
the ABO's
point of view. I would
have to agree with all of that. I mean, it is around in orchestras maintaining their commitment to excellence, reach, and innovation, and using all the digital tools at their disposal to look at their, as I say, to work in partnership with the musician. An orchestra is its musicians as well as its management, and working in partnership to make sure that that orchestra is absolutely embedded as that social, educational, and artistic resource for its community. And that mission is going to absolutely inform the orchestra of the future.
Mark Pemberton, Shirley Apthorpe, it's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you both very much indeed.
Thank you.
That conversation was recorded earlier this evening across the road in the Royal College of Music, and the producer was Helen Garrison. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. This is Andrew McGregor, live at the Royal Albert Hall for the second performance this season from the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle. And as you can probably tell from the atmosphere in the hall already, these two concerts have been some of the hottest tickets of the whole season. In the first half, we heard the piano concerto by Brahms that thinks it's a symphony, according to Simon Rattle. In the second half, he's going to conduct what he called the symphony that thinks it's a concerto, Witold Lutosławski's Symphony No. 3, which he finished in 1983, his 70th birthday year. Lutosławski had struggled with the idea of writing a classical symphony in the late 20th century, even while he was writing his second symphony 15 years earlier, wondering out loud whether the symphony was a relic bequeathed to us or perhaps a living organism with years of development still lying ahead of it. Simon Rattle harbours no such doubts about the third symphony.
The Lutosławski is one of the most powerful symphonies of the 20th century, bar none. It stands up to Mahler, to Shostakovich, to Sibelius. The orchestra who played it the last time with Lutosławski himself in the 80s all realized that this is as great a work as any of our standard played symphonies. And after the first concert, we opened the season with the Lutosławski. So many of the orchestra came to me and said, yes, let's play more of this, please. I knew him quite well, and it was wonderful. I found in my score, which I haven't conducted the piece this century, and I found in my score the very first postcard that she sent me before we'd met, and brought back this extraordinary civilized patrician man with the volcano going on in the middle. This wonderful thing Witold said, which is, I sometimes have a dream of waking up where they are only playing contemporary music. Not egocentrically, but just because as a composer now you feel like mustard and the feast of music. And we'd all like to be a beefsteak sometimes. It's very, very typical of him.
Simon Rattle on one of his favourite 20th century composers. And you remember him saying Lutosławski's third is a symphony that thinks it's a concerto? Well, a concerto for orchestra, a virtuoso showpiece that tests the brilliance of any ensemble. It was commissioned for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra some years before they actually received the finished thing, showing how much difficulty Lutosławski had coming to grips with it, abandoning then restarting work on the Third Symphony several times over at least a decade. So he settled on a two-movement form where the first movement is but preparation for what follows. The first movement's supposed to interest, attract and involve, he said, but never to entirely satisfy the listener, who's led to expect something more important, maybe even with impatience, which is exactly the moment the second movement appears and offers the main idea of the work. So in the Third Symphony, we get a short introduction, then the preparatory movement, and then the second movement. No break between the two movements, though. And here to conduct the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra in Witold Lutosławski's Third Symphony is someone who counts himself as one of the composer's biggest fans, Sir Simon Rattle.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Witold Lutosławski's Symphony No. 3, finished by the Polish composer in his 70th birthday year, given its first performance by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, with Sir George Scholte conducting the premiere in September 1983. Well, 29 years later, we've just heard it performed by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra under its principal conductor, Sir Simon Rattle. And those cheers as he re-emerges from the orchestra, having gone around shaking hands with as many of them as he can reach back onto the podium. And you heard the warmth with which Rattle spoke about Lutosławski before we heard the symphony. He was saying to me earlier that with Lutosławski's centenary coming up in January, he thinks it's more important than ever that everyone plays his music. He thinks that, like many composers just after his death, he suffered not a decline in reputation, but just in numbers of performances. He said he thinks that he and Esa-Pekka Salonen are effectively founding members of the Lutosławski Appreciation Society, and Rattle's programmed 15 works by Lutosławski this coming season. And he says there's going to be a cycle of the four symphonies at next summer's Berlin Festival as well. Rattle raises the score of Lutosławski's third symphony and presents it to the promenaders in front of him with that roar of appreciation as they pay homage to a work that itself pays homage to Lutosławski's admiration of Beethoven, but more particularly his appreciation of Haydn for symphonic structure. And by the way, the audience here at the BBC Proms has a real impact on the performers. When Rattle stepped onto the podium at this morning's rehearsal, the first thing he said after congratulating the orchestra for last night's concert was, "I wonder why we ever play anywhere else. What an audience." And I've heard the players themselves talking about the reception they've had at the Proms, one saying something along the lines of, what an amazing difference it is compared to the suits and subscribers they've just been playing for. They love it here. The six members of the percussion section getting their turn in the spotlight. Huge array of instruments. The brass on their feet as well. The winds. The well-known figures and sounds of flautist Emmanuel Powood and oboist Albrecht Mayer in the middle. And everybody else. I didn't mention the nationalities. We were asking about the balance of the orchestra at the moment. I think there are 26 nationalities represented in the Berlin Philharmonic. The three Brits I mentioned last night, there are five Poles, six Swiss, and two Australians. Simon Rattle, by the way, is rehearsing more consistently in German than the last time I saw the orchestra in rehearsal. He still throws away comments in English, and a lot of his one-liners and the humour is in English as well. He's talking to the orchestra's two concertmasters, and I think there's to be more music. Stand by.
It's such an extraordinary piece, but for the greatest audience in the world, what can you do? So it's 3 minutes of Dvorak, well, two if we're fast.
Dvorak's Slavonic Dance, Opus 72, number 7, I think. And much closer to 3 minutes than two. They're obviously in no hurry to leave. The Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, concertmaster Guy Braunstein, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle. Well, as we heard, he was in two minds about encores, but he told the orchestra this morning that the audience probably deserved one. Play it by ear, he said, we'll be prepared like good Boy Scouts. Well, what next? This is the end of the summer tour. The new Berlin season's just around the corner after a Berlin Music Festival concert a week on Saturday. That's with Ingo Metzmacher conducting and pianist Pierre-Laurent Aymar. Rattle just came onto the edge of the stage far enough to get the orchestra standing for us once again, but he's stayed off stage for this call. Now here he comes, back to the front of the stage. Mouthing thank you to his players, touching his heart and bowing low to the audience. Well, we've loved having them here at the BBC Proms, as you can hear. They've loved being here as well. It's so nice to hear how much the players and Rattle appreciate the unique welcome they get here. They experience nothing like it anywhere else, they've told us. Let's wish them safe home as they embrace one another in best Berlin tradition. And back in Broadcasting House, here's Jonathan Swain.
Andrew, thank you very much. Andrew McGregor there with tonight's live prom. Well, I guess we'll all take away different highlights from those Berlin Phil proms. For me, that's Lutosławski Symphony alone made their visits worthwhile, more than worthwhile, much more. And their two concerts are inevitably a hard proms act to follow, but then we still have visits to come from the Vienna Philharmonic and the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Ricardo Chailly and the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra.
A pair of weekend concerts on consecutive nights, starting with a musical tribute to a composer who looms large in the orchestra's history, Mendelssohn.
And on the second night, Messiaen and Mahler.
Two concerts at the BBC Proms featuring the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra.
Tomorrow and Sunday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
The Mendelssohn concert tomorrow night, including the Violin Concerto and the Reformation Symphony, and the Leipzig concert on Sunday night brings Messiaen's war memorial piece Et Expecto Resurrectione Mortuorum and Mahler's Sixth Symphony. 7:30 starts for both those proms, both of them as ever live here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. And we're back at the Royal Albert Hall in a little over an hour's time this evening for the second of tonight's proms, a unique collaboration between two greats of the British jazz scene, multi-award-winning guitarist Martin Taylor and trumpeter and arranger Guy Barker. Their new hour-long piece is inspired by and a homage to the legendary jazz guitarist Django Reinhardt. As Guy Barker puts it himself, Django was a fan of Debussy as well as Louis Armstrong. And we're back live at the hall for The Spirit of Django at 10:15 tonight. Before then, this evening's feature, a symphony for Detroit, a portrait of the American city seen through its world-class orchestra. That's at 9:30. And for the moment, Schubert, horns and male voices in the German forest. His Night Song in the Woods.
Still in the room.
The Southwest German Vocal Ensemble and the Maria Luisa Neunecker Horn Ensemble, conducted by Rolf Beck, in Schubert's Night Song in the Woods, Nachtgesang im Walde. Well, to follow it here on Radio 3, Villa-Lobos mixing Bach with Brazil. It's been said about Villa-Lobos' fusion of the two in his Bachianas Brasileiras that if there were any parallels between Bach and Brazilian idioms, they're only there in Villa-Lobos' mind. I suppose it depends how rigidly you interpret the expression a Bach idiom. As a child in the 1890s, Villa-Lobos sat fascinated as his aunt used to play him some of Bach's 48 preludes and fugues on the piano. And with Bach firmly lodged in his consciousness, it's probably not surprising he heard echoes of him in other kinds of music like Brazilian folk music. Villa-Lobos himself was a decent, if hardly outstanding, pianist, but he was married to one, and this, the fourth of the Bachianas Brasileiras, is the only one of them for solo piano. Villa-Lobos did orchestrate it in 1941, but the original gives a clearer picture of a number of its fascinating features, among them the way he imitates the sound of the organ in the second movement. That's a Bach-like chorale prelude, punctuated with the repeated one-note call of the Araponga bird. one of the few birds not noted down by Messiaen. A clearer picture, too, of what's going on in the fourth movement, where Baroque figurations ingeniously merge with complex Brazilian rhythms. The pianist here is the Brazilian-born Cristina Ortiz, and the piece opens with a prelude, hints here, perhaps, of Bach's musical offering.
Thank you.
dance called a miudinho that made its way from the beaches and village squares of northeastern Brazil into the salons and into the fourth of the Baquianas Brasileiras by Villa-Lobos, music from the 1930s that, with a grand gesture, simply blows away the boundaries between folk, jazz and classical. Playing it there, the Brazilian-born British pianist, Cristina Ortiz. Well, finally, in this short post-Berlin Philharmonic prom sequence, back to Berlin, in a sense, the Trapani Opera by Kurt Weill opened there on the 31st of August 1928. And from it, this is an English version of Seeräuber Jenny, Pirate Jenny. The orchestra is conducted by Ian Fraser. He also did the arrangement. And the singer, actress and general phenomenon recorded 50 years ago this year is Georgia Brown.
You gentlemen can watch while I'm scrubbing the floors, and I'm scrubbing the floors while you're gawking. And maybe once you tip me and it makes you feel swell, in a ratty waterfront, in a ratty old hotel, but you never guess to who you're talking. You never guess to who you're talking. Suddenly one night there's a scream in the night, and you say, what the hell could that have been? And you see me kind of grinning while I'm scrubbing, and you say, what the hell she got to grin? And a sheep, a black freighter, with a skull on its masthead, will be coming in. And you gentlemen can say, hey girl, finish the floor, get upstairs, make your beds, earn your keep here. You toss me the tips and look out to the ships, but I'm counting your heads while I'm making the beds, cause there's nobody gonna sleep here tonight. None of you will sleep here. Then that night there's a bang in the night, and you say, who's that kicking up around? And you see me kind of staring out the window, and you say, what she got to stare at now? And a sheep, a black freighter, turns around in the harbor, shooting guns from her bow. And you gentlemen can wipe off the laugh from your face. Every building in town is a flat one. This whole stinking place will be down to the ground. Only this cheap hotel standing up safe and sound. And they say, why do they spare that one? And you say, why do they spare that one? All the night through with the noise and to do, you wonder who's that person lives up there. And you see me stepping out into the morning, looking nice with a ribbon in my hair. And a sheep, a black freighter, runs a flag up its masthead, and the cheer rings the air. By noontime the dock is all swarming with men coming off of that ghostly freighter. They're moving in the shadows where no one can see, and they're chaining up people and bringing them to me, asking me, kill them now or later? Asking me, kill them now or later? Noon by the clock, and so still on the dock, you can hear a foghorn miles away. In that quiet of death, I'll say, right now. And they pile up the bodies, and I'll say, that'll learn ya. And the sheep, the black freighter, disappears out to sea.
The one and only Georgia Brown as Pirate Jenny from Kurt Weill's Threepenny Opera. The orchestra was conducted by Ian Fraser.
The 2012 BBC Proms season goes out with a bang. On the two nights before the last night, a pair of BBC Proms concerts with the Vienna Philharmonic and Bernard Haitink. Haydn, Strauss, Bruckner, and Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto, played by Murray Pariah. The Vienna Philharmonic at the BBC Proms. Thursday and Friday nights at 7 and 7.30 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's now 9:30. The Detroit Symphony Orchestra's 2012-13 season gets underway in a month's time. And a year ago, the future of the venerable American ensemble looked uncertain as management struggled to win back the support of players and audiences following one of the longest industrial disputes in American musical history, a musician's strike that lasted over 6 months. Petrarch Trelawney visited the Motor City and found the wounds of a bitter battle were still raw. Following the strike, would the orchestra go the same way as its hometown, a metaphor for American urban decline? Another chance now to hear a symphony for Detroit.
The start of their season is just days away, but instead of pleasing a full house, musicians with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra will be picketing.
Is it possible that we will never have a DSO in this city again, another Detroit Symphony Orchestra?
I couldn't imagine that.
Eight minutes past the hour, this is the Craig Folly Show on 101.9 WDET. Thank you very much for being with me on this Monday. We have a crew that has come here to make a documentary about the city of Detroit, using the DSO sort of as a baseline for this discussion. They've been listening to this program to get a sense as to where you're coming in. And I'm very excited to have in studio with me right now BBC Three radio host Petrarch Trelawney. You arrived just in time to see the DSO's return concert yesterday, as a matter of fact.
You know, it was a great moment. We thought we'd be coming to Detroit to make a program about a city without an orchestra. Then we got the news that the strike had been resolved, and great for us. It tied in with our arrival in the city, those first concerts.
Well, and I just want to get your impression real quick about the show that you did see.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this concert by the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. The orchestra would like to thank Strategic Staffing Solutions for sponsoring this week's performances. Thank you, and enjoy the concert.
Sorry to interrupt you. We're from the BBC. We're making a program about the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. Can I just ask you what it means to have the orchestra back?
Oh, we're just so happy that they're back. We've missed them while they've been gone.
This is what Detroit and the state of Michigan needs.
We've been waiting for this so long and praying that they would come together.
Back in 1914, Henry Ford revolutionized industry when he guaranteed his workers $5 a day. Tens of thousands flocked to Detroit, hoping he'd employ them on his Model T production line. The business acumen of Ford and his fellow car makers saw Detroit become America's fifth largest city, rich and confident, the drive belt of the American economy. 1914 was also the year that a group of Detroit society ladies invested $100 each to give their city a symphony orchestra. It grew alongside its hometown, attracting great conductors and top-class players, developing the Detroit sound and becoming one of the most recorded ensembles in the world. Fast forward to today, and Detroit is a very different place, hit earlier and harder by the industrial and economic meltdown than any other city in America, with the inevitably grim consequences for jobs and families.
Good morning, sir. The IRS called looking for you again. I'm running out of excuses.
Don't worry, I'll handle it. Hey, what are you guys doing? That's my couch!
Daddy, why are there men taking all our furniture out of the house?
Daddy didn't handle it.
This is famously the city where houses change hands for a few thousand or even a few hundred dollars, always assuming you can find a buyer. The population has shrunk by 25% in the last 10 years. Just over 700,000 people live here now. In 1950, this place was home to nearly 2 million. The Detroit Symphony Orchestra is back in business, giving concerts again, but only after that six-month strike over wage cuts and changes to work schedules. Its musicians echoing the painful labor disputes that the motor industry has gone through in recent years. This place is still dominated by the car. The towers of the Renaissance Center, where General Motors has its headquarters, are visible from all over the city. GM, Ford, Chrysler are part of Detroit's DNA. Brian and Kim Kennedy are married, both play for the DSO. He's a horn player, she's a violinist. For Brian, both the orchestra's and his personal history are inextricably bound up with the auto business.
My dad was a metallurgist engineer at Ford Motor Company for 32 years. He worked at General Motors 10 years before that. You know, there's definitely a mix of the mechanical, the precision, the engineering, and the artistry, the design in the automotive industry, and I think that definitely applies to the orchestra. There is an artistic quality, there's a collective agreement on the style that we play in. Paul Perret was the director in all of those recordings. It was probably the best French orchestra in the United States. Although a lot of those people are no longer with the orchestra, there's still a sound, there's still a precision, there's a warmth. And we have to play all types of music. You know, we do a lot of jazz, pop things. The orchestra's full of people that can play every style. Detroit is Motown, and I think that's a great association to have with the orchestra. Motown is the sound of rhythm and blues and symphony combined. If you go back to the original Motown records, those were all Detroit Symphony. All those string players were Detroit Symphony string players who would record between 11, midnight, to when the sun came up. And that's when all those recordings were made, because they had to do it when the orchestra was not working. It's a gritty city. Most people have a bad opinion of Detroit who haven't been here, who haven't met the people, who haven't found what the city is all about. Yes, we have a lot of geographical areas that are blighted, but overall, it's a great metropolitan area to live in. You know, when you talk about Chicago, New York, Cleveland, those are obvious great orchestras and great people. But Detroit's always been a little bit of the underdog. We have to try a little harder. We have to fight a little harder to get our orchestra, our reputation out there.
They make it look and sound effortless. The talented musicians of the DSO use their skills and dedication to fill the air with music. But a contract dispute threatens to bring concerts to an abrupt halt. Faced with a multi-million dollar deficit, DSO management is asking for deep pay cuts, upwards of 28%.
For a funeral for the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, but some supporters of the orchestra now fear the worst.
That's after the musicians rejected the management's last offer. That prompted a vice president of the orchestra to suggest in a published report that a new model...
I think we sent a message to the rest of the world, and especially this country, that this is a strong group of people that are willing to sacrifice to keep high standards. And I think that alone is attractive to somebody wanting to come here and audition. Say, this is a great group of people. They stood up against all forces for 6 months. Each person lost $50,000-$60,000 in order to really just maintain the conditions that a major orchestra would play under. We took a salary hit, but you know, everybody can adjust to less money. It was never about money, but we were able to avoid a two-tier pay system. We were able to avoid an orchestra that essentially is set up like a regional orchestra. We maintain our major orchestra status.
And we're going to get an update right now on the musician strike at the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. It's now well into its second month, and the impasse is in part over...
It was very tough. It was very tough. And the hardest thing was our kids, seeing them struggle. We needed to make sure that we preserved a sense of normalcy for them, and it was very difficult. There were times where we weren't sure that the mortgage was going to be paid. There were 6 weeks in a row where one of us was gone because we would be invited out of town to play somewhere else, and which we were so grateful for because it paid the bills, but it was really hard on the kids. I think if it were just the two of us without kids, we would have managed a lot better, but when we're trying to preserve what our family is at home, there was a lot of hard things.
It's been a long strike, but there could finally be some potentially positive news in this nearly six-month-long labor dispute.
Both sides met face-to-face for 17 hours on Saturday and reached a tentative deal late last night.
We're going to maintain our own integrity as players here to keep the standard alive, and we're going to work arm-in-arm with the board members and the management to continue to put Detroit at the top. It has to be a vision. It has to be a commitment from everybody involved. The people on that stage, the people behind the scenes, we're all superstars. We're all there doing things that benefit the world, that are a healing force in this world, that change people's lives when they come in the door. Music is the thing that transcends every culture, every barrier, and especially in these times, in what we've been through in the past 6 months, what the world has been through in the past 6 months, what music has to offer at this moment is one of the most powerful things. We're not just sitting back with a sense of entitlement thinking I deserve my paycheck. No, we're out there fighting in the ranks saying we understand how hard it is. We're with you.
The Detroit Symphony players eventually accepted a drop in their minimum base salary of 23% from $104,000 to just over $80,000 a year. The settlement came after a bitter six-month dispute. Neither side held back as they made their cases. Players utilised Facebook to rally supporters. Board members attacked the musicians' blinkered attitude. Music director Leonard Slatkin was accused by many players of being a management stooge, of sitting on the fence. But it's difficult to see how the DSO would have survived without severe cuts to its budget. The falling stock market meant its endowment fund shrank by two-thirds. Declining audiences and lack of sponsorship have seen it lose $19 million in the past 3 years alone. The strike didn't help either. And it owes the bank $54 million in loan repayments after a grand expansion of its home at Orchestra Hall nearly 10 years ago. Anne Parsons is president of the DSO.
Someone called it the perfect storm. The DSO has debt that it acquired in the early part of this century, and it was meant to be a debt that was going to be paid off in 2030. But the crisis for the DSO relative to this debt is that after 2008 and the crash of the markets and the bank situation just completely turning on its head, we owe the banks $54 million.
How sympathetic are the banks?
Well, I think they're pretty sympathetic because they could have closed us down any time in the last year. We've been in default. We've been paying our interest on the bonds, and we've been paying our letter of credit fees, which is, keeps you current, but the covenants attached to that debt have not been, we haven't been able to support those covenants. So,
did you have conversations with the banks?
Oh, when, constantly.
And are they making threats? Have they made threats?
No, they haven't made threats, but they're certainly anxious. I will tell you the strike was caused for great concern on their part as well. They were eager to see it settled. And now that it's settled, I actually am optimistic that we will reach some kind of agreement with them as well to sort this situation out.
Because it's a hard sell, isn't it, in a city like this where the public school system is in a state of collapse, where there's enormous urban blight and devastation. Actually selling something as esoteric as an orchestra is quite difficult, isn't it, if it's just about concerts.
And again, I find over and over again, people say, we love the fact that the orchestra's here, we respect the work you do, we are supportive of your work and what you do. However, then the big however comes. Their funding priorities are set, and they don't include funding the arts at this time.
Anne Parsons, president of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. The orchestra's long been reliant on the motor industry. It was hit badly when GM and Chrysler stopped giving to cultural organizations in 2008. 70 years ago, Ford money made the orchestra famous across America when it performed weekly in the Ford Symphony Hour, the car maker using classical music to show a softer side of its business, a world very different to its Detroit production lines.
People, well, here's my theory of what this country is moving toward. Every worker, a cog in motion. Well, that's the notion of Henry Ford. One man tightens and one man ratchets and one man reaches to pull one cord. Car keeps moving in one direction.
A change of direction to Henry.
I can see water, and I can see Canada about a quarter of a mile across the river here. Paul Ganson, historian of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, has brought me down to Detroit's waterfront, to the Henry and Edsel Ford Auditorium. Looks a bit sad now. It's shut off behind a wire fence, big sign saying, danger, asbestos. This was one of the great venues of the orchestra, wasn't it?
Yes. It was home to the orchestra from when it opened in 1956 until 1989, when the orchestra returned to its original home, Orchestra Hall. And in the meantime, though, this is where everything was happening.
Ford Auditorium, acclaimed for its acoustics, is the home of Detroit's world-famous symphony orchestra. Its summer symphony, community-sponsored, plays Under the Stars.
Was it paid for by the Ford family?
It was partly paid for by the Ford family, but it was really at the initiative of the Ford Motor Company dealers. It was the dealers who, in appreciation to Henry Ford, the founder of the Ford Motor Company, and his son Edsel, that they erected this monument to them.
Speed up the belt, Sam. Speed up the speed up. Learn to tighten the nut forever. Attach one pedal or pull one lever.
Henry Ford. Henry Ford. Henry Ford. Henry Ford.
It is now slated for demolition. It has been a couple times in the past, but then at the last moment there was a stay of execution, and I quite honestly don't know what is going to happen to it. It is still here, though.
And it was used for auto shows as well as concerts.
Yes, it was used for the annual meetings of the Ford Motor Company and Detroit Edison, and also for auto shows, introductions of new models. It was really a very good fit with what went on at Cobo Hall, the Veterans Building, and other buildings here in the Civic Center.
That the wealth has been ripped out of Detroit is clear here in the city's downtown area. The skyscrapers here used to rival Chicago, but many of them have now been torn down. The Book Tower survives. It's architecture of staggering elegance. It was started in 1916, 38 stories high, built to last. But now its windows are boarded up as it waits to be rescued someday by a loving developer. One of the few new buildings in the city centre is a rather gaudy glass edifice. Its glitz in is almost a defiant statement against the recession. It's headquarters of a mortgage company called Quicken Loans. I went there to meet Matt Cullen, one of a group of business and community leaders who are busy planning the restoration of Detroit as a rich, dynamic metropolis. Callan learnt negotiation skills during a 30-year career at General Motors, and he was brought in to mediate between musicians and management in the symphony strike and broker a solution.
I think it's not dissimilar from what General Motors just went through and what the autos have gone through and the auto suppliers and everything else. There's just been a sea change in the industry and in the economy, and people need to react to that. While General Motors went through their bankruptcy, Ford went through a near-death experience in that regard. I think the orchestra is right in the midst of that period themselves, and so they need to reinvent themselves and come up with a financial model that makes some sense.
Do you think they're in a position to do that?
I do. They are a product that people love, and they are an institution that's very important to the city of Detroit. But that by itself isn't enough. They're going to have to change the way they do things. And I think in many ways, that's what this strike was about. They are at the inflection point of a change, not only in the local economy, which has been tremendously painful for them to deal with, because the same General Motors and Fords and everybody else who used to write the checks to support them suddenly and immediately went away. So there was no real way to be prepared for it.
I guess that General Motors or Ford can make a strategic decision to say, we're not going to produce SUVs, we're going to reduce the number of vehicle lines, we're going to reduce the number of vehicles that we produce each year. It's more difficult for an orchestra, isn't it? Because actually you can't get away from the fact that it's one product, is concerts given by 85 musicians sitting on a stage together. You can't really cut that.
But I do think you can change and evolve your product. I mean, the whole point here is that the demand currently, and I think this is across the country and certainly locally, for folks coming in to see 100 great musicians on the stage at Orchestra Hall by itself has not demonstrated that it's self-sustaining. I mean, they are not unlike the folks at General Motors when they had a Caroline Buick whose average customer was 65 years old. I mean, it's not a path to success. And you have to find a way to be relevant in a changing world. I would disagree with the observation, because I think you do have to find a way to be different, to create different products, to create different entrees into potential markets, and then, though, pull them back into the orchestra and then educate them as to what's available. So it's not choosing to be something different. It's choosing to expose your product in different ways and to different audiences in a way to educate them as to the beauty of what you produce as an orchestra.
So at the risk of pushing the car analogy too
right,
far.
We'll push it pretty hard. But yeah.
I mean, what's the equivalent of the small car, or what's the equivalent of the greener car in the orchestra world?
Well, I think the chamber music or 15 or 20 musicians on the riverfront and some kids' pop concert kind of thing. You need to create the different models. I mean, how do you reach out to these different audiences in different ways? And part of it is outreach, too. I mean, it's going out with two or three musicians and explaining to kids where this sound comes from and how it comes together in an orchestra and how they should appreciate those different aspects of it. And I think historically, perhaps there was the cultural aspects of it, sort of provided for that education or at least exposure. And I don't think that's necessarily the case now, so they have to find a different way to do it.
Extensive education and outreach work is nothing new to European orchestras, but is still a relatively fresh idea in the States. And yet, of those American corporations still giving to the arts, many are far happier to support education projects rather than simply writing a fat check for another season of concerts. It's a time of seismic change for US orchestras. Some Detroit board members advocated sacking all the players and replacing them with brilliant, young, but much cheaper musicians straight out of college. But building an orchestra isn't like opening a branch of Starbucks. An orchestra's sound is built over generations. It doesn't come overnight. There are musicians here whose long tenure means they worked under legendary figures, men like Paul Paré and Antal Doraty, Detroit's most celebrated conductors. Decades on, the musicians who served under them still transmit that rich legacy every time they perform.
Just driven 25 minutes or so from downtown Detroit to Grosse Pointe, one of the smart suburbs of the city. Little town nestling on the edge of Lake St. Clair. This is a beautiful street, 1930s red brick houses, neatly tended gardens, perfectly clipped lawns. Here to meet Mario De Fiore, who's a cellist in the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, veteran cellist. He's been a member of the orchestra for more than half a century.
Hi.
Hello, Mario Di Fiore.
Mario, Petra Trelawney.
Oh,
nice to
please
meet you.
Come in.
Anne Di Fiore.
Hi, Anne. Thank you for welcoming us to your home.
Our pleasure.
Gosh, what a beautiful room.
We like to collect things from all over the world. In fact, at the beginning of our marriage, we bought furniture in London.
It's an English table, is it?
Yes, it is. Yes. This is from
My father came first time in 1922 at the urging of several of his uncles and cousins to come over and see about job and fortune here. And of course, it was after World War I, after he'd been a prisoner of war. I think he basically felt that he wanted a new start. He took any job he could. And he eventually ended up working for what was called U.S. Rubber, which became Uniroyal. This is the manifest of the ship my father first came over in when he came to the United States. I tell you, growing up in those days, Detroit was a wonderful place. Great school system. A really national and world-renowned school system. Two orchestras, two bands, theory and harmony classes, ensemble classes, a whole range of music education besides everything else that you would take in terms of American literature, English literature, and everything that in between in the sciences.
This is the cello room. This is where I practice and do some teaching. And what's nice
I got
is
into the orchestra fairly young. I was not quite 22. And over the years, Detroit became not a stepping stone orchestra, but a destination orchestra. So it was really marvelous to be able to stay and have the orchestra, which was really good in the 50s, grow into a world-class institution. I was very lucky going through the golden age of Detroit. Of course, it's also very painful to see what Detroit's gone through. I feel, in many ways, a great loss, mourning the loss of what the city used to be. It was really a hub of activity, of sports, of art, of music, and a magnet that drew people together. It was amazing. Boy, I tell you, I don't know what to say because I guess I would give a lot. I would give years of my life to be able to let other people experience what we experienced as people growing up in Detroit. This really vibrant place to exist, to really live in.
There are countless stories about how Detroit used to be great. Tonight, the story you'll see only right here.
A story of desperation, not people dying to leave the D. Fox's Charlie LaDuff introduces us to the people who want very much to stay and live in the city they love.
I'm Paulette Boyer. I'm sad to say I left Detroit, not because I wanted to, because I had to.
She was a grandma living alone in Detroit with her Bible and her gun. Then last year, she left.
Detroit has suffered greatly, and that's why something like this 6 months of agony, that's all I can call it, which I think was not necessary, is shameful, shameful. Because it didn't have to be. And while these are tough times, and everybody was in tune with having to make monetary sacrifices, it's not the time when you throw out the baby with the bathwater. I think the two biggest losers are the musicians and the people of Detroit. In a time when Detroit needed its few jewels, It makes me angry because this whole thing was unnecessary. When somebody gets an idea that they want to change the whole landscape of what an American orchestra is, and we are the test case, and I don't think anybody can deny that.
Where Mario De Fiore lives in the suburb of Grosse Pointe, the wealth is clear to see. Lovely houses, smart shops, flowers in the windows of an Episcopalian church. Heading back into town, the rows of manicured streets abruptly come to an end. A green sign proclaims Detroit city limit, and immediately all changes. Burnt-out houses, an abandoned, collapsing civic building, steel shutters protecting a liquor store, a few shiftless groups of people standing on street corners, waiting for something. Occasionally a police car speeds by, siren blaring, but budget cutbacks have hit the police hard. The rise of violent crime means Detroit now has the reputation as America's most dangerous city. There is clearly money, vast amounts of it, in the greater Detroit area, but the flight to the suburbs has left the city centre devastated. Those who stayed saw their houses become worthless after the subprime mortgage crisis.